A state lawmaker is concerned about the future of local journalism in Illinois, and the big flood in June prompted increased demand for replacement furniture from a Bloomington charity. Those stories just ahead on WGLT's Sound Ideas. Good afternoon, I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington Normal is the only metro area in the state to have fewer people employed than at this time last year, in spite of a low unemployment rate.
Financial services has seen some decline in employment.
If not for manufacturing sector hiring at Rivian, the labor force numbers in McLean County wouldn't look too hot. And in the next episode of McHistory, hear about huge prairie fires in the 1830s and 40s. Those stories and a Bloomington Normal News update just ahead. This is WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas, on 89.1 FM and WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Rivian Automotive, State Farm, and other companies in Bloomington Normal have been on hiring binges this year, and yet the Twin Cities is down 500 jobs over last year at this time, according to state employment data. Illinois Wesleyan University economist Mike Seaborg tells Eric Stock, looking at job numbers, though, month to month, even year to year, can be tricky.
I'm not willing to attach too much importance to it, but longer trend, we are seeing an employment decline and a labor force decline in our community. Of course, that's of some concern.
What do you attribute that to when the restaurants were having a hard time hiring people? We had heard anecdotally that some workers were going elsewhere. How many people have truly left the workforce to create this data point that shows a drop in the unemployment rate, but fewer people are working?
I'm not sure how many have actually left the labor force, but we know the labor force is declining. Indeed, it can be when unemployed people simply move. That's a possibility, too. But there are other explanations, too. To the extent that retirements accelerate during the pandemic, people opt for early retirement. That, too, would contribute to what we're observing with the decreased labor force. When one retires completely, one leaves the labor force and they're not counted as unemployed. That would contribute as well as the restaurant worker example that you used, actually moving out of the county. Also, it's possible that some people are being transferred within their firms to jobs outside of the community. So to the extent of somebody maybe being employed by State Farm or a firm like that, that has regional hubs, moves, then the employment decreases in the county. And again, it doesn't affect much the unemployment rate because those people have transferred out of the county.
And certainly State Farm has had a lot of transfers. They've been going on for years to all of their southern hubs, but yeah. They've also hired a whole bunch of people in McLean County this year, and Rivian did as well. You're looking at close to 4,000 jobs just among those two employers. So where would we be without that?
Yeah, and financial services as a group, and insurance is a big part of that group. Financial services has seen some decline in employment locally. So I'm not sure exactly where that's occurring, but Rivian really is the big story right now, and it's a reason to be optimistic about at least the near-term future in our community, in the labor market.
And we've also heard anecdotally that Rivian has been able to hire away personnel from other companies in town, perhaps with better pay, perhaps better benefits. State Farm is a company well known for good pay, good benefits. So is it possible that these workers they are hiring are just being hired away from other jobs in Bloomington Normal? So the increase in the jobless numbers aren't really that much better, though wages may be better for them.
That's a good point. To the extent that the new jobs that are being created, especially at Rivian, are higher paying, then that's a net gain for the community.
The McLean County Chamber of Commerce recently hosted a job fair, and they've said that the 65 or so employers had about 1,800 jobs available. Does this mean that there aren't as many people in that labor pool, if you will, as we might think?
I think that's right. Yeah. And this is not a Bloomington normal thing only, but tremendous shortages are abounding in the whole country. And part of it's pandemic related too. People are reluctant to come back to jobs, particularly where a lot of personal contact is exists. And if they're receiving unemployment compensation, particularly with the supplements, then there's even less incentive to come back into a risky environment. And so hiring during a pandemic is not an easy task, for sure, and particularly as the labor market tightens.
And as the expanded benefits you alluded to expired a couple of weeks ago, and a lot of employers were certainly counting on, a big surge in people returning to the workforce. Where do you see that settling as we move into fall?
Well, I think it'll have a positive effect in terms of people reentering the workforce at the margin. I'm not sure that the effects are going to be large, however, to the extent that people are still nervous about entering environments where there's risk.
That was Illinois Wesleyan University economist Mike Seaborg with Eric Stock. Bloomington Normal's unemployment is still second lowest in the state at just over 5%. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A Bloomington nonprofit helped more than half a dozen families whose furniture was destroyed during the summer storms that caused sewer backups and widespread damage. Frank Downs is executive director of Recycling Furniture for Families. Downs tells Eric Stock the organization has plenty of furniture to give, almost too much.
Generally, our supply of furniture has been pretty strong. You know, with the hot housing market here in Bloomington and Normal and McLean County, we've had no problem getting furniture donations. The thing that we were concerned about was how it had impacted some people who were impacted by the flood. So we had reached out to a lot of our partner agencies, especially Salvation Army, and told them that we had plenty of furniture and we'd love to help the people who were impacted by the flood.
So how much furniture did you give away because of the flood?
Hundreds of pieces of furniture.
Have you had an event like that in the past?
We participate in a lot of events, but we've never had an event like that, that, you know, so many people were impacted by a catastrophic event.
What were some of the pieces of furniture that were most in need?
A lot of it was the soft cloth. A lot of people had damage to couches, chairs, those type of things, especially the things that were in their basement, some wood furniture as well.
And so it sounds like you get a lot of your furniture when people are moving out, right? And so the market has been moving at such a pace that you've been getting a lot more donations. Is that correct?
Yes. And that's one of our biggest needs right now is because with the influx of people moving and the furniture we receive, we have about 8,000 square feet available to us. So the key for us right now is we are reaching out to a lot of our partners, State Farm, another of our partners and supporters, and through the community that we really do need more square feet to be able to handle this because it's kind of a feast or famine type of thing. So you'll get a lot of furniture in a few weeks and not much in maybe for a week or so. So the ability to hold and handle more furniture really would help us benefit the community.
Surge capacity, in other words.
That's correct. So we probably could use somewhere between 5,000 to 10,000 more square feet.
Where might you go to expand?
We have limited resources, so we've reached out to real estate companies, property management companies, and sometimes they may have some space that's available that is unused and people may want to donate to us. So we're just reaching out to a lot of the commercial real estate people to see if they know someone who might have some available real estate that they could give us, warehouse space.
Has the surge in furniture going out matched the amount that's coming in? Are you where you would typically be, or do you have more furniture now than you normally would?
After the flood, we had less furniture, but right now our client stream is pretty steady right now. So right now we have more furniture than we normally would have.
How close are you to busting at the seams?
We are at that point right now.
What happens if someone says, okay, I'm moving out, I've got an entire bedroom to donate? Can you take it?
We're sending out about two clients a day their furniture. So right now we're at the point where based on what we're getting at right now, we can replenish, but it's right at the max at this point. So if we are at a point where we cannot receive the furniture, we ask them, one, can they delay the furniture to a later date? Quite often that's the case for pickup, or we refer them to Habitat for Humanity Restore. They do pickups as well. They're a great resource for us. When we have excess furniture, we give it to them, and they're great. When we have a need, like a lot of times we run short on things like small kitchen tables, dressers, and tables, all type of things, we are able to go over there and they'll give us that stuff for free.
That's Frank Downs from Recycling Furniture for Families in Bloomington. He spoke with Eric Stock. Downs says the nonprofit took a financial hit from the pandemic as it canceled its two largest fundraisers. He says added donations will likely come in handy when the eviction moratorium expires next week. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Few people might realize it, but the COVID-19 pandemic has devastated the already withered state of news outlets across Illinois, the country, and frankly, around the globe. Newsrooms are closing or shedding reporters to the point of near extinction. State Senator Steve Stottleman successfully pushed for a local journalism task force, which will begin a year-long study into how to ensure quality local reporting survives, particularly in underserved and rural communities. Ahead of this week's McLean County League of Women Voters event featuring Stottleman, Colleen Reynolds talks with the Rockford Democrat about why Stottleman pushed for the task force.
Well, it's an estimated since 2004, more than 2,000 newspapers across the country have closed over the past 15 years. And that's a concern because people need access to local information. So this task force will study journalism in underserved communities, especially in rural areas, and make potential public policy recommendations.
Why is it important for you to kind of share this message and your passion about local journalism with the League of Women Voters?
Well, the League of Women Voters is a great organization. They're concerned about community involvement and making sure the local community has access to all the information. I'm a former journalist myself. I was a TV news anchor and reporter in Rockford for over 20 years, and now I'm in politics. So I see both sides of the equation. And while, you know, politicians may not necessarily like to answer tough questions to local reporters, I think we all realize the importance of local communities having access to information. And I think just the interest in both areas made me realize this is something that is a concern. People need, if people don't know what's going on in the community, they can't make informed decisions and hold the powerful accountable.
We have seen a climate in which journalists or journalism hasn't always been appreciated. Are you concerned about that as well?
Well, we certainly have heard a lot of rhetoric the past couple of years that somehow journalism or reporters are not good for the country and somehow investigations are somehow undemocratic. And it's been a real drumbeat that is working against the importance of the watchdog role that journalism plays, especially local journalism. And so I think this is just part of that effort to make sure that we need objective, unbiased reporting and information for local communities.
Who is going to be on this local journalism task force? What the types of people and really what are they going to be doing?
The task force is made up of right now 15 organizations, mainly representing journalistic organizations, associations that represent different forms of media, print, radio, and broadcast. The task force will include representatives of academic institutions as well. So from government, academic institutions, and representing the media, hopefully we can get a good conversation going as far as what needs to be done. I have no preconceived notions as far as what the results will be or what we'll discuss. I really want an open discussion. I just want to start the conversation that we need to make sure that local journalism, especially in rural communities, remains a thriving force in our community. Again, it's so important that people have access to local information. Where you live, where your zip code is, should not depend on the type and quality of information that you get.
There have been some new emerging models for journalism. Some things that come to mind is, you know, Block Club Chicago with subscriber funded and local journalists covering just one neighborhood or one geographic area. You also have Capital News Illinois, which has become a pretty strong force in a short amount of time. What do you think of these models, and do you think they are sustainable?
That's a really good question. I think they've had great success so far, and I think obviously is journalism tries to come up with new business models because what is currently working is not working. So I think we're seeing kind of solutions spring up on their own. You know, you mentioned websites supported by foundations, philanthropy, unique organizations like Black Club that really have kind of redefined local journalism. I think those are all potential solutions to what that business model may look like. But clearly, the current business model, it needs to be updated, and that may or may not have a state government role. Again, I think the purpose of this task force is what role, if any, should state government play in helping to ensure there's local journalism. It may happen, you know, solution may happen on their own, as we're seeing with Black Club and some of the interesting developments that have taken place over the past couple of years to provide local news.
So you're not necessarily convinced it's going to take some sort of public financing to ultimately keep local journalism alive and well in Illinois?
I don't want to answer that question. I mean, I think some solutions that other states have looked at is more of some type of public funding. Are there ways that you could persuade media outlets to close local news gaps and more money for public broadcasting? Can we encourage news organizations to collectively negotiate with companies such as Google and Facebook, which a lot of that advertising dollars have gone for instead? So again, I have no preconceived notions. There may be some type of public funding recommendation, policy recommendations, but I'm not coming into this task force with this is what we should do or this is where we should steer the discussions. I really want to hear what the different task force members have to say.
That was State Senator Steve Stottleman talking with correspondent Colleen Reynolds about Stottleman's upcoming speech at the League of Women Voters of McLean County membership recruitment kickoff on September 29th. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. There's not much prairie left in Illinois. Once there was a sea of tall grass across much of the state. In this episode of our series McHistory, we listen back to a time when the grass tops waved and rippled and hear about the hazards there, too.
My father's farm was just south of Ellsworth, a mile or more from the head of the Sagamon River. This bottom land in the fall was covered with tall grass as high as a horse's neck. And then the fire got into it. The creek being dry, it was alarming for those who lived in the path of the flames.
Born in the summer of 1837 in a spacious log cabin in Old Town Township, it was a four-room cabin. Mary Ann Cheney Marmon leaves several really fascinating manuscripts entailing her accounts of what life was like during the early settlement period.
Hello, my name is Jennifer Malloy, and I'm a volunteer for the McLean County Museum of History.
This is Bill Kemp, librarian, McLean County Museum of History. Being born in McLean County in 1837 makes you an early settler. After all, the county isn't established until late 1830, and Bloomington doesn't get underway until 1831. She wrote about the interactions with early Euro-American settlers and indigenous people, including the Kickapoo and the Delaware. She wrote about social life and housekeeping. And I think most interesting in some ways, she wrote about prairie fires.
In staying the process of tree fires, a fire was started burning spaces. In this way, they were more easily extinguished.
It's hard for us to capture in a mind's eye today what the Grand Prairie was like during the arrival of Euro-Americans in the 1820s and 1830s. Literally, a sea of waving perennial flowers and grasses from Little Bluestem to Golden Alexander.
When well underway, they were fearfully grand and frightful to behold, especially at night. A more beautiful sight could scarcely be imagined. When the miles and miles of roaring and leaping flames could be seen sweeping over the hills at a tremendous speed and lighting the whole heavens with a brilliant glow.
Only 0.01% of all prairie in the land of Lincoln, in the prairie state, remains today. So to call ourselves the prairie state is somewhat of a dark joke in a way.
If the fire was then seen to be coming dangerously near, all hands turned out to fight the foe. They put on old clothes and took older clothes to fight the fire with. They tied them with sticks and poles. Men's apparel was the best implements. Old coats, pants, or vests, not taking fire so easily. The men mounted their horses armed with wagons of defense and rode away as fast as their horses could carry them.
Fire certainly shapes the emergence and persistence of the Grand Prairie. The deep fibrous roots of prairie plants really protected grasses and perennial flowers from periodic burnings. Not only that, increased the growth and productivity of the plants in the soil to have periodic burns.
Furrows were plowed a half or a quarter of a mile from the fence to protect the fences and crops. The fences represented a money value that they were anxious to protect.
And these fires, we're now coming to understand, were not only natural, set by lightning strikes and other means, but were also of a human origin, set by indigenous people, sometimes accidentally, but often to clear heavy stands of grass, sometimes to channel game in large hunts.
These fences were what were called worm fences, from the zigzag manner in which they were built. They were made of split rails laid 6 or 8 feet high. These rails were made from trees cut into logs, and then the logs were split into rails and hauled many miles. Being in this zigzag form, the corners held an amount of grass that had been blown there, thus making it impossible to save the fences when once they caught fire. These fences are now almost entirely replaced with other material. Sometimes miles of these fences were burned, involving much loss.
William B. Carlock, an early settler, said, "Such beauty as no human tongue could describe." That was his memories of the Grand Prairie of his youth.
"When I was a little girl, I watched these fires with a childish awe and wonderment."
You heard the voices of Bill Kemp and Jennifer Malloy of the McLean County Museum of History. The McHistory series is a co-production of the museum and WGLT. McHistory brings you the words and writings of people from McLean County in years gone by. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT, made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media.